not able to take new phone calls, but we welcome your comments at drshow.org or join us on Facebook.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. For this month's Reader's Review, Marilynne Robinson's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Gilead, written in the form of a letter from a dying preacher to his beloved son. It begins as an account of his son's begats, family history, and other things he won't be able to tell him over the course of his growing up. It evolves into a way for the preacher to work out unresolved moral issues. Joining me in the studio, Reverend Derek Harkins at the 19th Street Baptist Church here in Washington, D.C., Susan Page of USA Today, and the very Reverend Samuel Lloyd. He's Dean of the Washington National Cathedral. I don't know whether you have read the book. If you haven't, you've got a treat in store for you. I must say, having now read it for the second time, I was so moved. I had tears in my eyes half the time. I do want to welcome you. Whether you've read the book or not, join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So good to see you. Sam Lloyd, tell me what the word Gilead brings to mind for you.
Gilead refers to, comes up a number of times in the Old Testament, and mostly it's a place where trouble's going on. People go running away to get to it. Jacob runs and hides there. It's a place, it's a town that, through the New Old Testament story, has various sorts of difficulties and family difficulties.
The great phrase
from the prophet Jeremiah, there is a balm in Gilead. Gilead is a place that's needed balm. And so Marilynne Robinson seems to have chosen this image of a small community where there has been a lot of complexity going on.
And Derek Harkins, what does it mean to you?
That's true, and I think along with that, the measure of the idea of there being a balm in Gilead, and that in the midst of the turmoil, in the midst of the suffering and strife that Robinson unfolds so beautifully, there's this wonderful calm recognition of the peace of one's mortality, and I think Reverend Ames does that so well in the course of this story to let us know that in the midst of the turmoil, there is indeed a balm in Gilead.
Susan, you have an even more realistic and practical sense of Gilead.
Well, we do know that the author based Gilead on an actual place in Iowa, a place called Tabor, Iowa, which had an abolitionist minister who preached there, very much like the grandfather of Reverend Ames, the narrator of this story. He had a stop on the Underground Railroad. He stored arms that John Brown used in his raids on Kansas during the Bleeding Kansas period. So there is a real story behind this fictional story, which of course she's aware of because she's lived in Iowa now for 20 years at the Iowa Writers Workshop.
Were you as moved by this novel as I was?
I like the novel very much. I love the very spare, grave language. It made you, I think, slow down in reading it. I read it more slowly than many books I read. And as someone who was born and raised in Kansas, who didn't step foot outside the state until I went away for my freshman year of college. I love the appreciation of the Great Plains because, you know, we're used to people making fun of us, people on both coasts saying that Kansas is a place and Iowa is, well, a place you fly over. And in this book, there is an appreciation both for kind of a distinctive, dry Midwestern humor and also an appreciation for the landscape of the Great Plains, which is something that perhaps takes a little time to cultivate.
Mm. But, Sam Lloyd, there is such tension going on here. There is the tension that the Reverend Ames feels because he has a heart condition. He knows he, at 76, 77, has not longed for this world. He has a 7-year-old son by virtue of a second late marriage. His first marriage ended when his beloved wife dies in childbirth and the child dies with her. So he is not only writing this letter to his young son, he's working out all kinds of internal problems.
Yes, and it's very moving to watch at this very slow pace his grappling with one set of issues after another. One set is working through the complex relationships with his grandfather and his father, grieving over the life he lost when his first wife died, what he describes the 40 years of loneliness he lived until this new marriage came. He's also working out, so what has my life meant as a pastor in this tiny place? He calculates he's written something like 67,500 pages of sermons, and he's wondering, what did all this add up to? And and there's a real struggle, a tension in himself. Was this a life well lived? Mm-hmm. And a sense of a need for reconciliation. And then, of course, the tension starts building when Jack Broughton, his godson, comes home, and all of a sudden a whole array of issues get stirred up. But also, I think simply the part of what's so moving as you go through it is as he's writing these pages, it's this letter to a son he'll never know grown up, and wanting to pass on so much, but he's processing so much as he does it. He imagines so many times connecting back, thinking that when his son reads this, he will be in eternity. And what will it be like for the two of them to be in relationship then? So he's working through all things about time and age and ministry and where is God in all this and how does it all add up?
You know, it's interesting because as you read this, you're almost ready to use the term melancholy when you talk about Reverend Ames. But I find that along the way, there are those moments where he'll make a statement or he'll have a reflection upon his own life in ministry that shows a transcendence above that. And while he talks again, you're right about the long measure of loneliness after the death of his first wife. It's almost with and he even says so himself, almost a gleeful sense of youthful exuberance when he encounters his second wife, and he's left literally speechless. And you see those moments along the way. Another thing that I think that Robinson does so well, she has this wonderful, and I don't know if it's Midwestern humor per se, but it's absolutely nuanced and beautifully done. You know, the fact that I began reading the portion where they talk about the horse who was stuck in the tunnel that the abolitionist had dug, and I'm thinking, this is awfully involved. And after about a page and a half, I didn't want the story to end.
Yeah.
And again, yeah. So there's a wonderful transcendence, even in the midst of what might at first measure look to be almost a melancholy rendering of one's life. But I think that the wonderful thing about this book that really is so powerful is that there's a transcendence above that. And certainly, I don't know if this ends up being a spoiler alert or not, but I'll just say certainly at the very end of the book, I find that there's just a profound sense of the transcendent overcoming, you know, the travails of life.
And Susan, there's the wonderful gift of friendship that's also a very important part of this novel.
His great friend, also a minister in town, who names his son after Reverend Ames, much to his distress, as it turns out. His good friend doesn't understand it. The portrayal, the picture that he paints of his friend, the minister, is quite wonderful. At one point he says he dozed off as he tended to do during difficult conversations, which I thought was a wonderful gift, and one I'm going to try to remember. The book is suffused with religion, with religious imagery, with the melancholy of facing death. But it is not a sad book, right. I didn't think. It had a very quite optimistic and interesting vision of heaven in his mind, and it was filled with this appreciation of the ordinary things that happen in daily life.
When you think about the naming of Jack, it came as a total surprise because his friend, as you said, another minister but of a different denomination, our writer is a Congregationalist minister. The other, I think,
Presbyterian.
Yeah. They had decided or said they were going to name the young baby some other name, and then at baptism, they name him after his good friend. Quite a shock.
Quite a shock. It's a strange twist, and John Ames doesn't know quite what to make of that. And it ends up launching this lifelong, complex relationship as Jack Broughton becomes one of the prodigal sons. There are a couple of them in the story, but someone who goes away. And all through his being away, and then when he comes back, John Ames himself is trying to make sense of the fact that he's linked to this young man and then this grown man, and somehow he can't get through to him, and he's lost his way. So one of the ways that John Ames will see himself is as the good son who never went away, and he's dealing with this prodigal who lost himself badly.
The very Reverend Samuel Lloyd. He's dean of Washington National Cathedral. Also here in the studio, Susan Page of USA Today, the Reverend Derek Harkins of 19th Street Baptist Church.
More Diane Rehm is just ahead here on WAMU 88.5. Good afternoon. I'm Elliot Francis. It's 219.
With the rising cost of fuel, you may have a vehicle that doesn't fit your needs anymore. Get some extra mileage from your used vehicle by donating it to the WAMU 88.5 Vehicle Donation Program. Call 866-WAMU-444 or visit WAMU.org. The hot weather brings out the cool summer closeouts at local auto dealers. So, if you'd like to close out the ownership of your old car, truck, or RV, WAMU 88.5's Vehicle Donation Program can help. We'll arrange for the pickup of your vehicle and provide the paperwork for a possible tax deduction after it's sold. Consider donating your used vehicle to help make your favorite programs possible. Call 866-WAMU-444 or visit WAMU.org.
This program of the Diane Rehm Show was recorded earlier, so we're not able to take new phone calls. But we welcome your comments at drshow.org or join us on Facebook.
And welcome back for this month's Reader's Review. Our choice is Marilynne Robinson's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Gilead. I have three wonderful guests here in the studio. Susan Page, many of you know, who sits in for me so often. She's Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Reverend Derek Harkins is Senior Pastor of the 19th Street Baptist Church here in Washington, which I have had the privilege of attending, and the very Reverend Samuel Lloyd. He's Dean of the Washington National Cathedral, the Church of the Country, which I am privileged to attend. Join us, 800 833-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Do join us whether you've read the book or not. The two wives of the Reverend Ames seem extraordinarily different, Susan.
The first wife, really a childhood sweetheart, a great love of his life, and then, as you said earlier, tragically dies in childbirth. The second wife, much younger than Reverend Ames, shows up at his church one day. He notices her in the back of the room and shows up again, and then doesn't show up one Sunday, and he's very distressed because he's clearly drawn to her, but he feels...
He doesn't know why.
He doesn't know what to do about
it.
Worries about the difference in their ages, and she finally takes steps toward him. She goes to his church every day. She starts to bring food to his house and work on his garden, as many women in the community do for their pastor. And he says to her one day, "I don't know how to repay you." And she says, "You should marry me."
Well done.
Quite a moment.
Right. That's his forthrightness, her forthrightness in action. And it shows this is a no-nonsense. Seems to be not a highly educated woman, quite shy, wants to stay out of the limelight, keeps reading to learn while she's living there, wants to catch up and be part of the conversation. Very strong woman, but coming from very limited background.
But there's a mystery going on here. What is the relationship between Jack Boughton and Reverend Ames, second wife? How did you read that?
I was saying earlier that it threw me for a moment because I thought, well, this isn't the kind of novel where that sort of suspenseful turn of events would all of a sudden take place. And I really did wonder. And what I found to be more so the case was the issue really arose in Reverend Ames' mind, in the sense of in his diminishing years, if you will. Here's this young and vigorous, at least by way of appearances, young and vigorous man who's very close, if not the same age of as his wife.
And he keeps showing up at the house.
And he keeps showing up. He plays catch with the son, and he's there at church, etc. And I'm thinking that it had as much to do with Reverend Ames trying to sort out his own sense of relevance in his relationship as much as if there were any ulterior motives on the part of Jack. At least initially, that's what it...
How do you feel about it, Sam?
I think Jack is hanging around a lot. And
too much for my taste.
At first, you can be a little skeptical of this, of Ames's rising concern about this, his meditation on covetousness, thou shalt not covet, the 10th commandment. He goes to work on that in himself. But more and more, Jack's around a lot. And then there's that one amazing scene where the wife and Jack are talking back and forth, and Ames is dozing off, but is he? And no one quite knows how far he's gone, while this thing gets more and more direct. And then he starts to bestir himself, and it all breaks off, and they go away.
But two outsiders, Ames' second wife and Jack, I thought maybe there was a connection there that would not be the kind of romantic or, you know, inappropriate connection that is sometimes suggested, or maybe suggested, maybe it's a reflection on us that we see that as a possibility. You hear Reverend Ames a worry that Jack, who has been a mean person in the past and treated people in mean ways, cruel ways, is going to do the same to his wife and his son after he is gone. You see that as
That's
an item of great
worry.
Concern to him.
Yeah.
And It's interesting that not very much happens in this book. This book is basically inside Reverend Ames' head, but there is this story that evolves. Jack shows up. He's not mentioned till page 68. You're pretty well into the book before you even are aware of his existence. But the whole rest of the book is Reverend Ames, not all of the rest of the book, but much of the rest of the book is Reverend Ames trying to come to terms with his need to forgive Jack, why he can't do so, and what ultimately happens.
And, of course, we learn later in the book that Jack has impregnated a young woman, that the young woman had a child, We don't know if he wanted to marry her. We don't know if her family rejected him. We just know that there is no connection between father and child.
You know, it's interesting. I took note of the fact that, and there's so many passages in this book as a pastor that I just sort of looked at almost from a homiletical sense. Boy, yeah. This would preach wonderfully.
Exactly.
And one of the pieces that really jumped out at me is, at least in the paperback version of 129, where he talks about Abraham and Isaac and the Akedah, which is the binding of Isaac, and the tensions between a father and son, and how that is reconciled and not reconciled. And I just thought that was a profound theme that just continues all the way through. And even with Jack and his child, the unreconciled nature of that relationship, mm-hmm. you know, sort of struck me as part of that same theme. Whereas, you know, here he talks about that even more earlier on. And it's the same thing with his grandfather in Kansas. And you know, so there's a real consistency about the tension between fathers and sons or offspring.
Absolutely.
And whether that gets reconciled.
And, of course, the Reverend Ames, as a young boy, when he is 7, 8, 9, goes with his father to Kansas to find the grave of the grandfather. And what a story. They
Amazing.
Have no money. They have no food. They're stopping at various houses, sometimes even stealing sand.
Right. It's a strange pilgrimage, and what we're seeing through the whole book is people working out their relationships
yes.
with their fathers, sons, I guess it's all sons, and so on that journey, the father was the pacifist, the grandfather was a warrior for abolition. Great tensions in there, but somehow the father has decided that part of his legacy is to go find that grandfather's grave. As you say, it's as grueling a journey as you could imagine, as foolhardy, it seems, as you could imagine, but somehow a piece of laying that relationship to rest is going and making sure that he is well buried, wherever that is. But it seems to go on for weeks, if not months,
yes.
this long. And they turn up later back, and people thought they disappeared.
There is no more vivid character in this book than the grandfather, who, of course, is deceased before this story begins. But she describes him at one point as a wild-haired, one-eyed, scrawny old fellow with a crooked beard, like a paintbrush left to dry with lacquer in it. And after seeing his grave, he writes, "It was the most natural thing in the world that my grandfather's grave would look like a place where someone had tried to smother a fire." Because this was a man who was on fire against the stain of slavery and battling it, but battling it with as a warrior, telling his parishioners that they needed to go fight this war. And that period in that part of the country, in Kansas and Missouri and Iowa, was a very bloody period.
And he loses an eye in that battle. And then the younger describes walking around the grandfather to, at times, be out of his vision or to be within it.
Right. You know, it's interesting, and maybe not to overwork the metaphor, but the fact that the grave is referred to as a place where somebody tried to put out a fire. I can't help but think of an altar and once again, Abraham and Isaac. And it's interesting because I wrestled with the idea was the younger Reverend Ames' pacifism, did that translate into an ambivalence about the issue of, well, at this point, no longer abolition, but certainly race and racism? And he references several instances in the book where there were obviously the burning of a church, a black church in the community. And that sort of was a question that hung out there for me.
So it took you all the way from the Civil War to just before the Civil Rights era. And at its center for everyone is this tension, because we learn later that Jack marries an African-American woman,
right.
And this tension continues. We've got a lot of callers. Let's open the phones. 800-433-8850. First, let's go to Ferndale, Michigan. Good morning, Kim. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Diane. It's such a lovely opportunity to talk to you.
I'm glad.
I just wanted to say that Gilead is definitely one of the best books that I've ever read. My copy of it is dog-eared with all the passages that I felt so connected to. But, when you go back, I think the book is primarily, well, not primarily, but that struggle and that tension with Jack Bowden was like, I read that and I was just, every time he entered the picture, it was just, I would tense up as I was reading it. But then there's the companion book that she wrote, Home, which is the same story but told through Jack's eyes. And I didn't think that I would like it as much because it seemed like it would be so repetitious, but it was a completely different book, and it was all written through Jack's perspective. And you understand the character of Jack so much more and what drives him to do a lot of the things he does. And I would really encourage your listeners, if they loved Gilead and they haven't read Home, to read the second companion piece, because I was astonished at how much I really enjoyed the second book.
Well,
I didn't think that I would.
Guess what, Kim? We have decided for next month's Reader's Review to follow Gilead with Home.
That makes me so happy.
I'm so glad, and I'm so glad you've enjoyed this one and recommend it so highly. I totally agree with you. Thanks for calling. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Leavittsville, Virginia. Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning, and thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have not read the book, but while I was listening to your show, I was reminded of a conference that I went to last year with the Reverend Cynthia Bourgeau, who wrote the Wisdom Jesus. And we studied the Gospel of Thomas and did a lot of different types of approaches to Christianity. And my point, one of the points that I want to make is the clergy, almost to a person at that conference, towards the end of that conference, was pretty much in the same position that I think that Reverend Ames was, in that questioning the validity of the life that they had spent in the priesthood or in the ministry. And so my point is, it's not just fiction that these faults enter people's minds. So that's my comment. And Cynthia Bourgeau is absolutely outstanding.
Thank you, Sam.
Yeah, I do think that the nature of the pastoral vocation is in there. I read it differently. I read this as a man who has loved his vocation, but part of what's so powerful is the ruminating on the complexity and the dark side of everything. I think there is a deep gratitude in him. Even there's that wistful thing that he could have left to go join his parents on the Gulf Coast, but he decided to stay there, and he thought he was doing it simply out of loyalty to his
Democrats
parents. But in fact, it was his calling. And we see, I think, a profound gratitude that pervades every page of this, and a sense that my life has been a difficult, complex life, but what a life.
And let us not forget that the Reverend Ames' brother, Edward, chose a totally different life. In fact, went to Europe. His father thought that both young men would follow him into the ministry, but Edward, the brother, went to Europe and came back a total atheist and so disappointed his father that it broke the relationship.
He encounters Feuerbach and comes back, you know, very
Tell
much.
Tell me about Feuerbach. I've never read Feuerbach.
It's been ages since I've read Feuerbach. I'm going to defer in a moment, but I'll just...
I bet Sam can tell us.
I will say this, though, that I really do think, again, and for anybody to read this and think that the Reverend Ames is questioning the validity of his life, I'd say again that I think he very much sees the value and he's ruminating on it. He's trying to sort out all of those precious jewels within his life that now he can reflect upon as he moves toward earthly mortality. And so I see it as a very hopeful and an uplifting book.
Let's go to Lehi, Utah. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. I have three things I'd like to mention. Number one, I think it is the best portrayal I've ever heard of a clergy person. I'm a retired military chaplain as well as clergy. Secondly, I think it may be the best psychological study ever written, and I'm out on a limb here, in America. Thirdly, I don't know what our guests might say, but it occurred to me as I wept into the last pages that, in a sense, there is only one character in the book, and that is the Reverend Ames. And all the other characters are, in fact, parts of himself, which is what makes it, to me, a psychological study. Jack is one, his wife is one, even the six-year-old boy, and even the ancestral characters.
Fascinating analysis, and certainly something for all of us to think about. We'll take a short break and be right back.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Nandi Show, America's story before the revolution, the pre-colonial history that shaped our nation, plus the challenge of keeping the Peace Corps relevant, responsible, and respected in the 21st century. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
And we're back with this month's Reader's Review, Marilyn Robinson's beautiful novel, Gilead. It not only won the National Book Award, it was awarded the Pulitzer Prize. She followed it up with a book called Home, which we're going to follow up with ourselves next month. Here in the studio, Derek Harkin, senior pastor of the 19th Street Baptist Church here in Washington, the very Reverend Samuel Lloyd, Dean of the Washington Cathedral, and Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Our last caller made three points. The first, that he thought this was the best portrayal of clergy he had ever read. I'd be interested in your thoughts. Derek Harkins.
I love the fact that he speaks to the, and I think maybe the word loneliness was used before, but the sense of solitude that oftentimes accompanies ministry, and yet at the same time how in that solitude he found a measure of fulfillment. I think it's a wonderfully respectful book with regard to the clergy because it's not cloying. And the theology that Robinson raises is incredibly profound, and it drove me to Wikipedia to find out if she had had any background herself, because she does some of the most profound exegesis.
She did a lot of studying before she wrote this book.
Yes.
After she had gone off and done some other things. What about for you, Sam Lloyd?
I wanted to read a very brief passage that expresses the pastor's frustrations. He talks about the difficulty of trying to get his congregation to catch the radiance in things, the vital life going on inside everything, everywhere, that life is itself the miracle. But then he says in a moment of frustration, television can be the worst. You can spend 40 years teaching people to be awake to the fact of mystery, and then some fellow with no more theological sense than a jackrabbit gets himself a radio ministry, and all your work is forgotten. what we get in this amazing book is as profound and beautiful a spirituality as I know. I think that she's a spiritual master here. And she's giving us a spirituality that crosses the bounds from Orthodox Christianity to the spiritual but not religious. It is a way of embracing the earthiness, the grace, the joy of the everyday. And so seeing that and then seeing how it can get so corrupted by the ways Christians talk about it is one of the sources of despair for him.
With how Christians talk about it.
How things like radio ministries, how hard-edged, absolute answer Christianity loses what he thinks is the essence, which is the mystery. He keeps saying, I know more than I can say, and there's so much more than we will ever be able to articulate. Mm. We're in the midst of something overwhelmingly beyond us and overwhelmingly good. And it's our job to try to say what bits we can to help people make their lives in the middle of that.
And Susan, one of the other points that our caller made had to do with what he thought was the profound psychological aspect to the book.
Yeah, Paul mentioned this as being, all the characters being parts of Reverend Ames' own self. And there's a passage where Ames seems to be acknowledging that in a way we're all made up of pieces of our family members and others who've gone before us. She writes, in every important way, we are such secrets from each other, and I do believe that there is a separate language in each of us, also a separate aesthetics and a separate jurisprudence. Every single one of us is a little civilization built on the ruins of any number of preceding civilizations. It goes back, I think, to that idea of fathers and sons, of parents and children. And almost all of the characters in this book are quite three-dimensional. Even the characters we see only briefly or in passing, you get a sense of them in a context of their place in time and as being having characteristics that are complicated.
Do you know what the Reverend Ames' wife's name is?
The first wife was Louisa, but I don't think I know the second wife's name.
We don't hear her name.
Who is Lila? I think it's Lila.
It's Lila.
And I think the time it comes is when is it that moment when Ames is sleeping sleeping, and that word gets said right there, and there's an intimate moment when Jack says that to her in that room.
But we don't know the son's name.
No.
We don't.
Never.
It's interesting to have Jack be the one to say Lila's name rather than to have the husband call his wife Lila. The idea of his seeing her in the back of the church the first time she walks in. Why that connection, do you think? Why that connection between the Reverend Ames and Lila all the way in the back of the church?
I think you have to take into account the idea that if one is a pastor and he's preaching and the moment is transcendent, that somehow that she has whatever qualities that sort of pierce through all of that. And he says as much in the context of how he encounters her and then how they end up realizing the intensity of their relationship. I think it's a moment that pierces through everything that he has as his identity as a minister, that it happens there, in the context of him being a minister.
And what is the word that Jack uses about his marriage to Lila? He says something like, you yourself have had a very unusual marriage. Because the Reverend Ames is thinking back on what Jack has done. The one repeating theme that keeps coming up are these sermons that are in the attic. thousands of pages of sermons. And the Reverend Ames is not sure any of these thousands of pages is worth anything. Have you ever felt that?
Well, it goes back to how much it resonates with the people who are hearing and what transforms. And I think you end up being pleasantly surprised on occasion. See, I'm going to hold on to this sense of transcendent hopefulness that somehow it does.
You've gotten through.
It adheres. Somehow it's transformative. But you can't help but wonder, you know, do my efforts, end up being as fruitful as I'd like for them to be? And I think it's a very realistic assessment on his part that there's no telling, how effective and impactful my work, my ministry, my sermons, the relationships I've forged, how impactful they might ultimately be.
What about you, Sam?
It's fascinating hearing this reflection. Sermons are events that happen in time and in a place. When words are spoken, usually in the context of worship, but the minister is saying everything he or she knows to say as best as possible, and people are responding. And then that piece of paper afterwards is a record of something that happened. And sometimes going back to those, you can see the spark that was in it, and sometimes you wonder if there ever was a spark in it. But it's I think we all wonder about, so what does this stack of sermons add up to for a lifetime? And at least what I have to say is I'm not writing books. I'm not even writing essays. That's a record of an effort to say something truthful to a group of people gathered to try to make sense of life in the context of this Christian story. And it was what it was. And what we would talk about, it's the work of the Holy Spirit in people's lives that allows them to receive this. And there is a Spirit working in people in ways that I can't begin to imagine, and I hope this can be part of their own growth.
Is the Episcopal Church different from the Baptist Church in that what you're preaching to or on is the gospel of the day? Is there any difference?
Not in this sense. I mean, I think the profundity of the gospel and the transcendence of that in terms of how it impacts upon people's life, that's when you get into the weeds of particularities around, doctrine and church politics, that's a different discussion. But I think, what we're talking about here and what we see, especially in as Reverend Ames lifts it, is, again, a transcendence of this truth as he understands it. I wanted to just, when we talk about that whole sense of does this all matter, does this really mean anything, at the very end of the book, he says, I'll curtail the quote, but it says, what have I to leave you but the ruins of old courage and the lore of old gallantry and hope? Well, as I have said, it is all an ember now, and the good Lord will surely someday breathe it into flame again. Mm. And I think what an incredible measure of trust. He says, what I've done is what I've done, and I'm trusting in a benevolent God. Earlier on, he talks about prevenient grace in that same, a little earlier on. But the bottom line is he's saying, I've lived a life in the fullest measures that I can, and I'm trusting that it will have impact and meaning, even on my 7-year-old son, whose life I will largely not see, on my wife, on all those people whose lives I've touched.
And Susan, you must reflect in much the same way. I mean, before you came to USA Today, you wrote other articles for other newspapers. Did you ever find yourself wondering, how much of a difference can I make as a journalist?
Absolutely. And persistent or enduring, and what is something that will be forgotten next week? And I think one thing that as a journalist you try to do, and in many other lines of work, the deeper you go into your craft, the longer you spend at it, the more you want to do things that will be enduring as opposed to something that is here today and gone tomorrow. And it's hard, I think, to make clear judgments about that yourself. It's to a degree dependent on other people. I was interested just after the passage that you just read is the very close of the book, where he says, "I'll pray that you to his son. I'll pray that you grow up a brave man in a brave country. I will pray you find a way to be useful. I'll pray and then I'll sleep." That's the very simple, profound ending of the book.
Did it make you cry?
Parts of the book made me cry, yes. And especially the sense of wanting to protect his child and being unable to do so. We're all unable to protect our children, but especially as he looks to his death while his child is still so young.
And wondering, even as he's trying so hard to come to some sort of forgiveness, reconciliation with Jack, wondering at the same time how much of his wife's life is Jack going to be involved in. Did you find yourself wondering that?
You know, I wondered that until the very end, where we find out that Jack, in fact, is in another relationship that means the world to him, and that he's unable to live fully because of the continuing strains and injustices of race. And at that point, Jack becomes suddenly a much more sympathetic figure than he's been before then. And it casts his relationship with Reverend Ames's wife, I think, in a somewhat different light.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now to Jacksonville, Florida, to Mark. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. This is amazing. I've listened to your show for years, never called, but I'm a Presbyterian minister. I'm what they call a tent maker these days, and I pastor a small church in North Central Florida, and I can understand the main character's questioning about the effectiveness of ministry and so on and so forth, and I empathize with that because I guess I wonder about the reality of being able to fulfill the call that I think most clergy people feel or Christians feel. You know, the idea is to change the world, and it's a mighty tall order.
It sure is. Sam, do you feel that that's your challenge?
I think that is the vision behind all ministry, is to make it become more of what it was made to be. But the one of the things I love about this book is Ames brings it down to the concrete. What he's trying to get people to do is open their eyes and see the miracle going on around them. And moment by moment, a brief passage I would read is toward the end, too, is trying to get people to see whether it's looking at a lovely couple that gets caught in the rain and the raindrops fall on them,
Or
these kids throwing a ball back and forth, and he just sits there and says, I can't believe I'm in a world like this. I've got to keep noticing these things. But then he says this, and I think this is the spiritual power of the book. It has seemed to me sometimes as though the Lord breathes on this poor gray ember of creation, and it turns to radiance for a moment or a year or the span of a life, and then it sinks back into itself. And to look at it, no one would know it had anything to do with fire or light. The Lord is more constant and far more extravagant than things seem to apply. Wherever you turn your eyes, the world can shine like transfiguration. You don't have to bring a thing to it except a little willingness to see. Only who could have the courage to see it?
And isn't it interesting that the grandfather has only one eye?
You know, I hadn't thought that. That is right.
Because she does talk about vision.
Yeah,
a great deal, and the ability to not only see but to understand. And here we have a man with one eye. I love this discussion. I love this book. The book we've been talking about, Marilynne Robinson's Gilead, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, the Reverend Derek Harkin, Susan Page, the very Reverend Samuel Lloyd. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And next month we will follow this with Marilynne Robinson's novel, Home. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.
Hi there, I'm Rebecca Shear, host of WAMU 88.5's Metro Connection, and welcome to Door to Door, our weekly trip around the region. Today we visit Capitol Hill in Northeast and Southeast D.C. and the city of Falls Church, Virginia.
I'm Vera Sisolak. I live on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. We're immediately east of the Capitol out to the Anacostia River. We live in a historic district. Most of the houses were built between 1860 and 1910. They're row houses, and they're generally brick. People here feel that it's a neighborhood that belongs to those of us who live here. And as such, we try to maintain relationships with the people who own the stores and the restaurants. We tend to be a little insular in that sense, that we want to keep our spending local and keep our children in local schools and just make it a neighborhood where people talk to each other. People know who their neighbors are. We have an annual block party here. It's that sort of activity that brings people to Capitol Hill and keeps us here.
My name is Andy Rankin, and I live in Falls Church, Virginia. Falls Church is inside the Beltway, right up next to 566, sort of between Fairfax County and Arlington, a little bit to the west of Washington, D.C. In the city of Falls Church, we have our own city council, or a mayor. You know, you can call them up at home if you want. You can see them at the farmer's market. We're known for the schools. We have a small school system, so there's two elementary schools, a middle school, and a high school. All the kids go to the same schools together throughout. So it has a bit of a private school feel, but it's definitely a public school environment. Falls Church is interesting. People have talked about the village atmosphere. The city has been around for a long time, and there's a little downtown area. I actually live on one side and work on the other side, so I often walk through. And it's, you know, antique shops and restaurants and, you know, there's a nice barber shop.